Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
I'm opening. We have an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Anatomy of a Movie here on the Popcorn Talk Network. Those are some scary sounds.
Okay.
That means yes. We're in for a scary movie. We're talking, of course, the movie, the scary movie of 2015 that comes out before Insidious 3.
Yeah, good for them. That was smart planning.
There you go. So we're doing Poltergeist. Wow, that was a quick little sound bite. Was that a sound bite or a song? Anyway, we're talking Poltergeist, the 2015 film, alongside Dimitri Panos.
Hello, movie fans.
I am Phil Svitek, and you can call us the horror division because, I don't know, I enjoy the horror genre. As long as the film's good, it has to be a good one. I don't watch every single horror film.
Yeah, just like any other genre, you take the good with the bad. I love the horror genre. There's some pretty shitty horror movies out there. But there are some fantastic ones. And when you're in a really good horror movie, that's to me, I put that on the level of watching a great comedy at a movie theater. Mm-hmm. Like, it's laughter is infectious, but so is in fear. Like, it's in a great horror movie is like riding a great roller coaster. It ratchets up, it ratchets, and you go up, and then the scare comes. And to be sitting in a movie theater and see people jump up and wave, sort of kind of like that. That's a great feeling where it's that cathartic release of either a scream or the jump. It's an awesome feeling. Yeah. And when you share that communally, in a big theater, yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, you're just grabbing the guy next to you.
It's happened. I went to a horror movie one time a while ago, and the woman screamed and she jumped and literally knocked the popcorn out of my best friend's hand, and popcorn was flying everywhere. I mean, that's great stuff.
So there you go. Lesson of the day, bring a raincoat.
Bring a raincoat or your popcorn coat. You don't.
Because it could have been a drink.
It could have been worse. Yeah.
All right. So Poltergeist, produced by Sam Raimi, directed by Gil Keenan. And by the way, for me, the best part of this movie, starring Sam Rockwell.
Yeah.
He stole the show.
I love Sam Rockwell. We're not talking opinions yet, but I love Sam Rockwell. I personally think that he was greatly miscast in this movie.
Okay.
So I liked him as him being Sam Rockwell, but it's tough. Way Back was just on cable again, and I just went 5 minutes into that movie and then seeing him, and I'm like going, yeah, I just felt he was miscast and Poltergeist.
Okay. So before we, let's get general opinions out of the way, and then we'll dig a little bit deeper. So let's start with you, Dimitri. I know a little bit lukewarm on this.
A little.
Especially because you have such a history with the original.
Yeah. Well, okay. Just a little preface. Well before this movie was released, I had a conversation with a friend of mine. And he's like, so what's your take about this new Poltergeist? And I said, my biggest fear on this movie is going to be if they just brush over or just completely whitewash out the humanistic family nature of what makes the original movie a great horror movie. Meaning, the original movie did back in 1982, it really showcased and gave audiences something that really hadn't been seen before, and it took place in suburbia, and it really grounded the family unit from the parents to the kids. And the focus was on the parents, and there was a reality to them, and in which they were real people, You know, they smoked pot in their bedroom, and yet they cared for their kids, and yet, and then they became more or less the focal points. They had to be the glue to hold this family together during these crazy, supernatural, scary, scary events. And I'm like, this movie, if they capture that, then they're going to be halfway there. They will at least have gotten what Poltergeist, the first movie, is all about. This 2015 Poltergeist, well, it made me angry. It did not capture any of that at
but,
all.
But on the surface level, the way you described it, you have that. I mean, you
but
have
you
sad
don't.
Panties.
You don't, though.
And you had but, the drinking. Yeah, like, but you can see, like, that description, if you had to, like, describe
it,
it
was
it's
so
the same.
Forced to me because none of it, it was cliche. And the sad panties scene, oh, so now we're in an age where maybe we can't show our parents smoking pot. And there was a great scene. Like, there were so many scenes that were amazing. And when I think back about the original Poltergeist, this was lacking any humanistic touch and any type of real humanistic kind of parenting, that there was nothing relatable, really. And things that didn't make sense, like, number one, this family in the 2015, they're looking to buy a house. And then we learn early on that the husband had just lost his job at John Deere. And my first thought was, wow, they must have given you a big nut, because what are you shopping for a house for? Your wife isn't bringing home any money. She's a fledgling writer, but we don't see exactly her, any of her writings anywhere. And you just lost a job. So your first thought is to go buy a new house.
Is it a new house or is it a downgrade?
I couldn't tell. I mean, it's still
that's
a new...
But that's what I gathered. They had a better house and they downgraded.
Any kids would dislike to move. And that house didn't look like... I'd move into that house. I mean, you know, sans it being haunted. The alcoholism I found to be just cheap. I didn't find that it was earned. I didn't find how he kicked the bottle to be earned, because again, that mirrors a great scene from the original that they tried to redo here. And to me, it just came
about
off.
The worms and the
sink.
Yeah,
the worms, the sink, and like it just, you know, when he looks at the bottle and, oh, I'm going to throw the bottle away. There was like a cheap James Bond joke where he comes out of the car, out of a beach in a car, and the guy's drinking his wine and he throws out the wine. I didn't find that any of the parental or any of the humanistic touch was very much earned at all. And then they took the focus away from the parents and focused it on the kids, particularly the 12-year-old boy. And this bothered me, too. With the 12-year-old boy, they set up a reason as to why this kid might have his insecurities and fear. Like, you know, his mother left him in a parking lot or a shopping mall years ago. And my whole thing is, what about him just being 12 years old? Like, when you're a young boy, you're afraid of a lot of things. You might be afraid of being left alone in a mall. You might be afraid of the dark, period. Like, you might be afraid of the tree that's outside the door because it's ugly. You might be actually afraid of thunderstorms with no other psychological reason other than you're a 12-year-old kid. People expect that if you're afraid, they understand. The first Poltergeist got that and worked on those fears so that the audience related to them, where this Poltergeist sort of kind of force-fed us why they might be afraid of certain things when there was no reason, and then they just turned into... It tried to be a Blumhouse kind of a fright fest, and it just, for me, it just didn't work at all.
Yeah, for me... Was it scary? No, it was not scary. However, did I mind it? I don't, you know, maybe because I don't have the history that you have with Poltergeist by any means, because I did not see the original Poltergeist.
Really?
I did not.
You did not, and you still have not.
I did not, and I have not.
Interesting.
But
you
I
should.
May.
No, really, you should. Seriously.
One day I will see all these amazing movies. If time permits. Time is a...
I understand. And let me just say, you maybe at this point, you may not find it amazing. And in fact, you may even go as far as saying that it's dated, because it was in 1982. But I think that is some of its charm, because it definitely was a sign of the times, where I found that in this Poltergeist, you know, the television plays a big part in the original. It's a big part of the movie. And I was wondering how are they going to do that. And I will listen, as much as I dislike the movie, there were aspects of the movie I thought were cool. So in what they do in this movie is we got the plasma screen TV. I did like the effect of the hands seeming like they were in, and they were, you know, I like that.
Yeah. You had a couple iPads.
A lot of iPads. A lot of technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The previous owner was a techie.
Yes, he was.
So I really enjoyed that. I mean, I, you know, in terms of the visuals were good, but again, the, you know, it's one of those things, like, for me, I don't think you can make things scary just by how scary they look on screen. You know what I mean?
I agree with you.
Like, the bodies, or however you want to describe them, they were ugly and they were frightening, but
sure.
It's not like they're scary. And maybe I don't know what defines, like, what scares me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the reasons why it's you and I is because every single person on Anatomy of a Movie, perhaps including John Comfort, doesn't like scary movies because they get scared.
Sure.
And I keep in a lot of times, and not to make this sexist in any sort of way, but a lot of times, whether the staff or the hosts here, there's a lot of females and things like that.
Sure.
We like to, you know, we all like to hang out. All, as you know, we all do stuff together.
Yeah.
And I said, let's go see this movie. And they just don't want to see scary movies.
No, they did not.
And
I'm
like, guys, it's not scary. It's like, half the scary movies are not scary. That doesn't mean half the movies that I've seen are bad movies, you know, Poltergeist included, but they're just not scary.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you bring up a good point because there are, I guess there are levels of what scares you, what doesn't scare you. The original Poltergeist scared me, but it scared me in a, you know, fun, visceral way. Like when I was a kid growing up and watching, first starting to get into horror movies, you know, there's a lot. There's the, you know, parents, friends alike saying, go into the movie and just keep on repeating to yourself, it's only a movie. It's only a movie. It's not real. It's only a movie. So you start off with that as a little kid and, you know, like watching movies like Psycho. But Jaws was my first big one. My big first really scary movie, and that's literally scared the shit out of me. I didn't go swimming even in a pool for a long time. But, yeah, I think there are degrees of scariness in what is good, like... like the scariness of like The Exorcist for me. Okay. The Exorcist is truly a scary movie. I love it to death. It's a great movie. It's a great movie. It's a great horror movie, but there are times where I have a hard time watching it just because it is so deep in the core, that whole possession religion thing, that's scary. It's uncomfortable to me. You know, as opposed to my favorite horror movie, Halloween, which I love that movie. I, to me, it's my favorite horror movie. And the first time I saw it, it scared me, but it was more the tension. It was leading up to something that would make me jump, as opposed to like The Exorcist, which was way more visceral, way more ground, like, you know, the possession of this girl, the makeup effects, things that were going on, where Halloween was taught. And it was a pot boiler, and it was all about the escape. Is she going to make it? Where's this shape going to show up? And, you know, and in Poltergeist, there's a classic. It's a ghost story that goes on the, that used the premises as a kid of things that would go bump in the night, whether it be underneath your bed, inside the closet, or the tree outside. So it worked off these archetypal fears off of kids, which at the time I was a kid, and, you know, you're still growing up in the world. And I found the kids to be way more relatable in that movie. Like, one of the things, one of the flourishes in it, that they do in the original Poltergeist that you'll note right off the bat, the little boy, who the movie isn't focused on really, but he has a traumatic thing happen to him in that movie, is that in his room he has Star Wars bed sheets. He's got, like, an Indiana Jones thing. He's got all this thing. Yes, Steven Spielberg produced the movie, but... as a kid myself, who was, you know, a little bit older than he was, I had the TIE Fighter, the X-Wing, I had Indiana Jones stuff, I had posters, I had soundtracks, I had this stuff. Like, it was easily relatable to me because he was a kid just like me. These kids, outside of having technology, there was nothing that discerned them from any other kid around. Like, they had no personality to me other than sort of kind of annoying. And that was sort of kind of bothersome. Sam Rockwell, who I do love, and his shtick just felt out of place. And I'm sorry to call it shtick, but his sarcasm and stuff just felt out of place in this movie. He's just better suited for, if it had it been a better grounded story, had you had a better director, I think Sam Rockwell can play very sympathetic and very protective. And that's the thing, too. The original Poltergeist, Jo Beth Williams' character comes off, when you talk about strong female characters, she is a strong female character who's backed up by her husband. And that makes this movie, you know, as a kid you watch and you go, geez, I hope my parents would be this way as well. These people, I don't know. It just didn't bring me in. You brought up the point about the closets, about seeing things.
Yeah.
Sometimes things are better left in the imagination to me.
That was, Jaws, out of necessity, they had to use the shark less. So, mm-hmm. I mean, is it a matter of showing whatever it is less times and just letting the imagination take wild and putting in a crap ton of score behind it that just makes you jump every single second?
I think it's just the way that it's directed. And again, I think for this PG-13 Poltergeist movie, I think they were just going for the haunted house kind of. They wanted to try to be Insidious and all these scores of horror movies that are coming out, whether it be like Ouija or things like that. And they care more about trying to get the jump out of the audience other than earning the jump of the audience. The tough thing with Poltergeist at this point.
Well, most times, I see that a lot. And that's why, like, especially in the first 10 minutes, I just know there's going to be one of those, like,
yeah,
false jumps. And I'm like, guys, why are you all scared? You know it's a false. If you study, like, just two horror movies,
right,
you will understand within the first 10 minutes it's a false jump.
And how it's executed, though, and we know it. We know that it's coming, but it's how it's executed in this movie. It was like, oh, yeah, it's a hand.
By the way, let me ask you this. Speaking of Sam, because he had that moment with the squirrel after, and he was, you know, he was doing his thing where he was possessed or being thrown around.
The squirrel is good, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, did anyone jump for that? Did you jump? For me, because of how I knew his character to be, I'm like, okay, he's making this up.
Oh, I knew he was BSing. Just because of how that character, I guess, was.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it's the Sam Rockwell. Look, we know he can be sympathetic. If you don't believe me, go watch The Way, Way Back. To me, that we talked about it, nominatable performance. You know, he was great as Chuck Barris. He was hysterical in Galaxy Quest. One of my favorite science fiction movies of the last 10 years is Moon, in which he's fantastic in. The man has, you know, and I know I'm just glossing over some of his highlights. I just felt in this movie, it just didn't carry. There was nothing for him. There was nothing on page that allowed him to be the sympathetic, protective dad as much, other than just he was a cliche, out of work, drunk, and you know,
he came
and then
home
it was
with the pizza.
Well, that scene didn't make sense either. The guy doesn't have a job. His credit cards are maxed out.
I thought he did get promoted. I was like, wait, did he get a job? Did he get promoted?
Well, yeah, but there was nothing. He comes home. He buys his daughter an iPhone. His son a drone, flying drone. His wife some jewelry, and I'm like, well, but wait a minute, the scene before is all his credit cards are maxed out. What, did he win the lottery that we didn't? Yeah, canceled. Canceled. Even worse. So,
which, by the way, I mean, that actually was a funny scene. It's like, this card is canceled too. Oh, man.
I mean, I don't know. I just felt that it was very cliche, and then it would set you something up and then did something completely opposite.
Mm.
And, The other thing that bothered me, too, is the twist. Like, to you, it wasn't a twist.
What was the twist? I mean,
well, in the original
Poltergeist, wasn't a lot of twists for
no,
me.
But see, in the original Poltergeist, we can talk about some of the differences. The family is already living in the house. In fact, it's a huge development project in which Craig T. Nelson, the father of that family, he is a realtor. He's selling these houses, and it's a cookie cutter suburban neighborhood, and he's living in phase one. Okay. And so when these supernatural events start to happen, first it goes from the whimsical to, wow, look at this. I can be dragged across the floor. And they're sort of kind of like, what the hell's going on? But then they become a little bit more serious in nature. And then we find out, you find out literally about three quarters of the way into the movie where a concerned Craig D. Nelson, his boss comes over. He's concerned because Craig D. Nelson hasn't showed up to work in like weeks. And they go for this walk and they're up in this hill. And the boss is talking to him how he wants him to be lead for this new development that they're going to be building up there. And then he lets out the bombshell that, hey, you know, they're behind a burial ground. And he goes, well, but we have the burial ground over here. He goes, oh, that's not going to be a problem. We're going to move the burial ground. He goes, you're living on what was a burial ground. We just moved the burial ground. And Craig D. Nelson's like, you built houses on a burial ground? He goes, yeah. We just moved them somewhere else. And you're like, oh, okay. So this is making sense. And then it comes out later. It's like, you moved the burial ground. Like all shit is breaking loose at the household. And Nelson confronts his boss. And he's like, you moved the burial ground, but you didn't move the bodies. And that is a big twist. And like, you don't know that this is going on. And in the movie, they tell you right up front, pretty much within the first 20 minutes of the movie, when they're at the dinner party, yeah. Hey, you moved on to a burial ground and blah, blah, blah. And I think they just didn't have enough
faith. Later, but not to that extent, not what you're certainly portraying.
That device was just so much, maybe they were relying on too many people having familiarity with Poulter, the original. I don't know.
I think to a degree, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this movie makes... I love when the daughter's watching the TV, right? And of course, it's the haunted house guy, yeah. And he's going to come back later. And other movies have used this technique of, like... It's just funny to me, a teenage girl watching this, and of course it comes back later.
Yeah.
And the twist being that it's former lovers. They're not husband and wife, but they're former lovers.
Uh-huh.
Now rekindling to an extent.
Yeah. Sort of, yeah. Yeah. And again, this was in the original, is a little bit bigger than that. I was curious to see how they were going to utilize the TV. Because, mm-hmm. Again, TV plays an important part in the original Poltergeist. And the trailers of the 2015... They did show how this was going to be sort of kind of repurposed in its way. And I found it to be clever. And I found it, okay, that could be chilling. You know, to me, that gave prospect that maybe they took the time. I did enjoy how they tried to work the technology into it. But again, whatever technology there was back in 82, you don't need, that house didn't need to be all teched out. For this to happen, I mean, there are supernatural spirits. They're haunting. They steal a daughter because they believe that the daughter is going to lead them out of limbo. And it's up to the parents to get the daughter back and protect their family. This movie sort of kind of like that line where the kid goes, this is my fault. I'm going to go get her. I was like, no. And he goes in by himself into the, I was like, I didn't buy it. At that point, I didn't buy that kid was, I understand he's overcoming his fears and he's going to go get his sister and he's taking responsibility. Great. You've made a good kids movie. Which to Sam Rockwell's credit, I will give him this. He was at, I believe it was like Sundance or Cannes, and he was promoting a movie there. And the interviewer from Collider, just at the very end of the interview, she asked him about Poltergeist, and he wasn't there to promote Poltergeist. And to his credit, and this I really respected him for, with a smile, and you know, she's like, I'm a big Poltergeist fan. Can you tell me anything? Like, what should we expect? Like, what, any changes? And you know what? He talked to the woman. He continued to talk to this interviewer for a good two solid minutes about this. And he did it with a smile on his face. Marissa Tomei was sitting next to him. And he said, you know, this version is more of a kids movie. Yeah. It's focused on the kids more. He's like, you know, and, And so they change focus, you know, and he admits this, you know, and he talked about that it's in 3D, and he did say, he goes, I haven't seen the movie yet. He goes, I enjoyed filming it. You know, I hope it came out good. You know, and the whole time he wasn't slamming the movie. Everything he did, he didn't have to. He said, he could have said, I'm not here to talk about Poltergeist. I'm here to talk about this. But he gave that interview 2 full minutes with a smile on his face, and he spoke positively of the movie and of the acting experience he had with his coworkers. I respect that.
I mean, the way I could best describe it, you're right. It's not scary, so therefore it's more of a kid's movie in that regard. It felt fast at the end, you know? And so I think this is one of those movies that if you just watch, you can consume, and then that's it. You will not have further interaction with this movie in that way. It's just, okay, you want to spend 90 minutes watching something that you could enjoy in the moment, but...
It was 90 minutes. I sound like the old codger, but again, watching the original Poltergeist, I'm going to get into a couple of... I want to do some comparisons between when this was released and the year that it was released and what that year meant to movies and such, but... Walking out of that with my high school friends and whatnot, we could relate. We could say, oh my God, there was a tender scene that was completely taken out of this. I don't know. I don't know if anybody who's watching, maybe you were, when you were a young kid, you were afraid of thunderstorms. If you didn't understand what a thunderstorm was, the loud sound could, you know, scare you. This was a big part of the original. And there's this great scene. And in fact, it taught me how to gauge thunderstorms and how far or close they are, but it was used to a great horror. It was used to great effect, in which Craig T. Nelson goes into the son's bedroom, and there's a big thunderstorm, and he's like, "Hey, there's nothing to be afraid about, son." He's like, "Look," he goes, "I can tell you how far away it is." He goes, "Every time you see lightning, start counting 1, 2, 3. When you hear thunder," he goes, "you know, they count it up to 3. He goes, "All right, the next time, I bet you it's going to be farther away." And they're like, "When you count, I bet you're going to get to 4 or 5. And the farther you can count out, the farther away that thunderstorm's going to go." And it was a really touching moment between father and son. Father leaves, and then there's this huge crack of thunder, and it cuts to parents' bedroom, and the kids are sleeping with the parents. Like, mm-hmm. This is a great scene. There was none of that. It was gone in this movie. And yet they had the thunderstorms, but they already set up that this kid has insecurities to begin with and that he's going to be afraid of everything. The tree sequence as well. I don't know. Just very missed opportunity. He had a great, tentpole. He had a great roadmap. I don't know. Did that scare you at all? Like, did you want to talk about that scene after? Because I talked about that scene going, oh my head, that I have a big cherry tree, crab apple tree in my yard, and that's going to be a scary tree, and I totally got it.
The more and more we talk about it, the more it just suffers from the fact that you have to, especially in horror, use things in a different way.
Right.
And the things that we're talking about, we can point to any typical horror movie and say, okay, that's happened there, right? Scary tree, someone walking around the corner, TV, closet, this and that. And so it's all thunderstorms. It's all been done. So how are you – what originality are you going to bring to it? So again, if this movie came out in 1945, it might be the world's scariest movie in the world.
No, absolutely. And we are jaded. We are jaded as an audience to that.
But that's – but that's good and bad because, you know, if you're new to the genre, then you might be able to find this quite scary. However, but it's also, to an extent, that is the fun. It's like, if you're a filmmaker, okay, now challenge yourself to go beyond that. You had the element of the non-believer kid, right? And then he's doing the closet thing, and it's suspenseful because the drill, and, you know, you think that it's going to get him. I don't think, does anybody die in the movie?
Nobody dies. No,
you know, and you thought, okay, this could be the first death that we see, and it doesn't happen. But it's very, Hitchcock, because it's just it just keeps coming and closer and closer.
That scene was well, and I will give that scene, even though you sort of kind of knew that his hand was going to get pulled on through, but that was a well directed scene with the drill bits coming through the wall. Yeah.
So. And, you know, but it's one of those things, again, the elements of it we've seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's its number one thing. And especially if you're trying to be, you know, more of a kid's movie, then how are you going to twist this on its head?
Yeah, no, and I don't disagree. I think it's very tough. But again, I'll go back.
It was shot, like very, very, you know, of course you got your darks and it's, you know, it's at night. There's thunderstorms and rain.
Yeah.
You know, and so you're playing, you got your lights and your shadows and you're playing with that. I mean, it all looked very, very good. And, you know, unlike, this isn't a Scorsese movie where you get the
right,
camera moving.
Right.
If you do, it's very, very slow onto the house. We got a lot of good establishing shots of suburbia, right?
Sure, absolutely.
And in that regard, I would have liked to, you know, I would like to see the suspense build up in that way. I think you were right. Had we not known it was on a burial ground, but you know, you make hints towards it. I thought the little bone at the beginning, I thought that was a good little thing, you know, nugget. And then eventually,
the bone at the beginning. Oh! You mean finding
planting.
The right.
You know, and had you kind of had more clues throughout, and that was like the big reveal that would have been, you know. But you play it one of two ways: you give the audience the dramatic irony, or you don't.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, and even before the original Poltergeist had come out, there were haunted house stories. You know, 56, you know, House on Haunted Hill. Robert Wise directed a great haunted house movie, the title of which escapes me. But, you know, and then you're right. Poltergeist gave audiences at that time something that they really hadn't seen before. Also, I have to throw in 1982, the slasher craze was in a frenzy where you had movies like A Friday the 13th were becoming more and more popular. But they were focused on teenage kids, not so much the family unit, you know, in suburbia. And that's what Spielberg excelled at. You know, he excelled at writing and he produced and he wrote Poltergeist that he brought suburbia to light. So people were able to, because he grew up in suburbia. So people were able to relate in one way, shape, or form. This one, they're moving in. I got no sense of any of that neighborhood, the neighbors, this, that, and it's
tough.
Well,
you didn't see neighbors.
No.
You know what I mean? Apart from the dinner party, but that was so short-lived.
And I don't even know where they were. I don't even know, like, how close they were in proximity, if they're neighbors or town over. But the thing that I'm trying to get at, between Poltergeist, between 82 and 2015, we have seen a lot of ghost stories. We've seen a lot of haunted house.
We've seen Ghostbusters.
We've seen Ghostbusters. And we've seen, you know, and then, you know, when you have a movie like The Conjuring, okay, The Conjuring is effectively a haunted house movie, okay? But what makes it great is that it turns certain tropes on its head and we see things. It'll take things a step further that they haven't been done before. James Wan was masterful in The Conjuring. One of the scariest films within the past five to ten years. He did the Insidious movies. Again, sort of kind of a haunted house movie.
Yeah, because it's all in there.
Right? And yet, they're showing us something that's different. He's delivering the scares in a fashion that, yes, we know that something's going to make us jump, but he plays on that, and then he'll do something either with camera trickery, which he's great at. He's able to show us and bring us a new type or a new level of fear. So we've seen haunted house movies. Maybe we've seen too much, so that by the time that we get to Poltergeist, it's like you better be pretty damn good at delivering and building, because horror relies on how you build up to the scare. It's not just a loud sound. Some directors rely on that. Like, just a loud sound will make an audience jump. There you go. But it's how you choreograph and what you're showing the audience. And it is getting harder and harder to do. But a movie like It Follows shows that you can have some originality in what otherwise might be a cliched genre.
Yeah. Yeah, I like
that. And this movie didn't have that originality.
I mean, part of it was, right, you strip away, you want to not be scared of a horror movie, strip away all the music and all the sound, right? But I would argue at the same time, there's still, you can look at the images and still be you can see why it would be scary as you build upon that, right? You can't just all of a sudden just use music and sound as a crutch. And I felt at times this did do that, because I'm looking at the visual, I'm like, if it wasn't for this sound, this is just this is nothing.
Right.
This is nothing.
Nothing's going on. Right. Right.
You know, you just got a couple of, you know, you got a ball rolling down. That's it. And so I felt, you know, even visually with the editing, they did use some things. They just relied on the music and stuff too mm-hmm. much as a crutch.
Yeah, and you're
when
right.
You could have, I think you could have tightened it a little bit, ironically, even though it is 90 minutes. And I think the ending should have been a little bit longer. I think you could have spent time there and gotten rid of some of the earlier stuff.
Again, I just have to urge you, find it somewhere and try to see the original. Now, the original...
I'm sure it's not hard. I'm sure.
Yeah, you know, just, because, okay, I mean, you know, we'll talk. The original was, quote-unquote, directed by Tobe Hooper, you know, who brought us the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But it is heavily, 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 heavily rumored that Spielberg did most of the heavy lifting on that movie. So, you know, you have different talented directors. The gentleman who directed this film is the guy that, you know, Lucy O'Brien, the director of the upcoming Poltergeist reboot. This guy is known for delivering an animated movie called Monster House. Okay. This was, I believe, a DreamWorks movie. Now, this movie, as a kid's horror movie, this movie played on those tropes that kids are afraid of. I don't know if you ever saw this. It's a very well-done animated movie that, for horror fans, if you're a horror fan, you're going to like this movie. Not because it's animated, so it's not going to scare the socks off you, but you're going to get it. You're going to identify with these kids. And I don't know, maybe that was one of his calling cards that Sam Raimi had said, hey, come on in, we got a script. Look, his directing chops were okay at best. I just felt that from a script-wise, they could have said, we don't need to go into the closet. We know that the closet is scary and that it's this conduit. We're going to save something for the end of the movie, just like you had a roadmap to do it. And they really went off. They went off road a lot and to very ill effect. It didn't work too well. And again, I think it's a problem. You shouldn't remake good movies. You shouldn't make what were already really good movies to begin with. Like, yeah. that should be a rule. Like, just, I don't have to remake this movie. Why doesn't MGM just re-release this movie? But I think MGM just saw an opportunity. They could do it sort of on the cheap.
So let's talk marketing. Let's talk reception. Let's talk critics and fans and all that. Because this is 2 weeks ahead of Insidious 3.
Yeah.
Is that bold or not?
I think, is it bold? I think they knew what they had.
Mm-hmm.
And let's not, you know, Insidious has, like, really, when you look at Insidious, it has done something. It surprised a lot of people. The first one, the second one. Like, and
I'm surprised it's still going. Like, I love the second one.
Same here.
But I was like, how are you going to, what is the third one?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't know. Yeah, I'm right there with you. And I just think they saw what they had in Insidious. Now they're onto the third movie. They've had some success and they probably feel that this will be successful too. So why don't we open up a Memorial Day weekend? We can get a jump on Insidious 3. We're going to have that 3-day weekend at the box office. We'll be able to capitalize on that. And then by the time Insidious 3 comes, we'll have made hopefully some money. We'll have foreign sales. Then we're going to have the aftermarket. Well, so,
they made their money back.
Yeah.
I mean, budget, without the non-PNA, $30 million?
It was $45 million estimated.
Overall?
I'm going to say, yeah, because, well, I'll put it to you this way. The total budget, including the hard drives and advertising, was $62 million. Now, when you compare that to even like a Conjuring or even the first Insidious, those movies were under like 10 to make. Yeah. Okay. So
what was the budget?
Because they're saying $62 million with print and advertising.
Okay, I get that. But
so the production budget I couldn't find. So I can only, it's about a 20, to $25 million disparity from your entire production budget to what your actual is. So I'm estimating that their production budget was anywhere from 40 to 45 million.
But even that, that's still... here's the thing, for this movie, that's really... Was it the 3D? Is it the graphics? Like, you know, at the end? Like, that seems... The Matrix was made for 60. I understand that's different times, but...
I mean, I can't imagine that this movie cost $10 million to make and that they threw $50 million to market. That I can't imagine.
I don't think it's... No, I don't... Here's the thing. Like, again, from my reports, I have about in the 30 to 40 range budget-wise production.
All right. So then they spent about...
Sam Rockwell?
30 to 40 million on hard drives and advertising? That's a lot. I mean, Fox can do it.
It's a lot.
That's a lot of money.
But I want to know more specifically, where does the production budget go?
I don't know. Maybe Rockwell did get a good paycheck out of it. I don't know.
Like, it just seems like an insane amount of money.
You know, there were special effects that were fair, but they weren't anything, you know. They were good. They weren't, like, eye-popping.
Yeah.
You know? I'm just
baffled by this number. I really am.
Yeah. And so to date, it's made about $30 million to date. Opening weekend domestic gross, it was like $22.6 million. So
came in third, right?
Fourth. Okay. Came in fourth, but you know, people were still saying that it did well. And I don't know if you want to talk about it now, if you have other things to talk about. But
no, we can talk.
This really rattled me because I want to do something that I haven't seen done in talking of this Poltergeist movie, because I've seen publications say, oh, it did brought in modest business. And then, you know, it was coming out with Tomorrowland, they're easy to jump on and say, oh, it was a slow box office and Tomorrowland didn't do anything, blah, blah, blah. But Poltergeist came out and it did okay. And I'm like going, well, I want to define okay in this instance because, and I don't even want to do it from a gross standpoint, I do want to do a... I want to compare. And so I looked up a bunch of... I looked up a bunch of box office stuff. Historical box office data. Now...
And this is for specifically for horror
this
movies?
This is specifically for Poltergeist. Okay. For the original Poltergeist. Okay. Number one, it should be known that the original Poltergeist came out in June 1982. Okay. June 4th, which is a Friday, up against, now it opened up at the time. It opened up against this movie called Hanky Panky, which starred Gene Wilder and Gilda Radner. A comedy with some laughs in it, but it also opened up against Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Now, a question is, why would you open up this Poltergeist movie? Now, Poltergeist had Spielberg's name all over it. It was produced by Steven Spielberg, a master of horror. Toby Hooper was directing, but Spielberg was in the forefront. Okay, but they opened up against what became the most famous popular Star Trek movie, Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. Now, the following weekend, okay, which was Friday the 11th in June, then you had this little movie called E.T. the Extraterrestrial open up. Now, granted, nobody knew at the time that E.T. was going to be the first movie to ever reach $300 million plus. But, you know, you get this horror movie by Spielberg. Then the following week, you've got Spielberg's E.T. But catch this. Poltergeist opened up on 890 locations when it first opened. That's under 1,000 screens. You want to take a guess. You want to take a guess as to how much money that it brought in on just under 1,000 screens?
Is that a... Oh. $10 million budget is what I'm being told for this movie.
For this movie?
That's via our live chat.
Okay, $10 million?
For the production budget.
Oh, and that was... I'm sorry, and who is that?
That was from Carrie Hamilton.
Hey, Carrie, well, thank you very much for chiming in, Carrie. I'm curious, and Carrie, if you're still online too, I'm curious as to the information, because spending $50 million on printing hard drive or hard drives and advertising is a lot, but 10 million. Whew. But in any case,
my guess, okay,
under 1,000 locations. How much do you think that that movie made? And on
10 to 15.
Yeah, well, that's being generous because there aren't that many movies that can release on that amount of screens this time. But it did about 7 million.
Okay.
It did about 7 million. Now, at the end of the day, it ended up in over 1,000 screens or 1,000 locations, and it ended up bringing in $76.6 million. $76.6 million at the end of the day. So that has a multiple, and by multiple, I'm meaning this is taking your opening weekend number
and increasing it exponentially.
And what the multiple it got to, you're talking about a multiple of about 11. Okay? A multiple of 11. Today, like if this Poltergeist opened up at 23 and it got a multiple of 11,
especially in June.
Right.
That's prime time.
Right. So we don't have multiples of 11 anymore. We have multiples of 2.5 to 3, sometimes 4, depending on the movie. So when you look at what it did and what it's doing, what the original did, and then it opened up throughout the year, it showed up, the original Poltergeist showed up at number 8 box office wise. As I said, $78.8 million. Okay. Meaning this movie, this Poltergeist, that's not going to come close to 70 when all is said and done. Its multiple might be 2.5, which would bring it to 45, 48, maybe. But as you said, Insidious is coming out. We've got Jurassic World is coming out. We've got Mission Impossible. We've got a lot of movies.
San Andreas this
weekend is coming out. Aloha.
Nah, for the women.
It's not going to be, that's not going to affect Poltergeist. But I'm just saying, if you, in today's standards, and let's take a look, have to look at what this Poltergeist opened up at over 3,000 locations. By today's standards, if you cannot beat the original, which opened up on a measly, at its widest, was under 1,500, was under 1,200, was under 1,100. And this movie, which is opening up so double what the original opened up, and it can't reach $78 million, I ask you, is that really good? Is that like, how can you, when something in 1982 so outshined you on far less screens, what does that tell you? I argue that the $21 million or $22 million, who cares? Like at the end of the day, because you didn't really put together that great of a movie, and you can't tell me that that's such a good opening when in 1982, the little 806 already brought in 7 million on its own. So, and then if you want to factor in inflation, I believe the original Poltergeist would be somewhere like $225 million. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to factor in like a comparison. So is that a box office? Is that a box office success? When something in 1982 fares a hell of a lot better than your modern day, when you have way more advertising, way more efficiency in getting your prints out, the social media and all that. Really? It's 26.
I think social media could have hurt it.
Do you?
I mean, nowadays, what I'm noticing and what I keep hearing is, because you used to have the whole weekend you used to open up, and if a movie got bad, then, come Monday, next week, now you're going to have trouble. But at least you open the weekend.
Sure.
Now it's like, okay, if the movie's not good, and everyone goes to see it Friday, and they're all excited, and all it hits social media that it's bad. Good luck with Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah, no, I agree. Know? And movies in the summer technically sort of kind of they cheat and they open up on a Thursday. So this one on Rotten Tomatoes got a 31%. I'm not too surprised.
Certified, fresh.
Yeah, and then its Cinema Score. This I was surprised a little bit. It got a C+. On Cinema Score.
I don't find that too surprising.
I would have thought a B minus B because, again, when you're talking like 21, and they had a good Thursday night showing. So those are all the questions that I ask. Is that, do we really, really, you know, when we look at a movie like that, you can take a snapshot back and look back in history and go, holy shit, Poltergeist, it came in number 8. Wow, like, this movie's not going to crack the top 10 this year. So, like,
here's the thing. I mean, it goes back to the argument of, should you remake something that was good, right? And it's one of those things, like, don't do it just to do it. If you really, I mean, you know, I how much do you gather that this was a passion project and people wanted to make it, right? If it was like, if it was you and I and we stepped up and said, hey, we love this movie, we want to do a new spin on it, we have a vision. And if we did that and we had to fall on our swords, so be it.
Okay.
But at least it's coming from a different place rather than like, oh, that, you know what, that was successful a couple years down the line. Let's see what we can do.
Yeah, I mean, my first thing would have been to, if somebody said, hey, Dimitri, you have the opportunity to remake Poltergeist, I'd say no. I'd say, why? No, just re-release the first one. Make a big deal of its birthday or anniversary. And just re-release that and get people to go. I mean, but unfortunately, unlike in the 80s and such, and even somewhat in the 90s, it's tough to re-release a movie because our screens are so filled and saturated. Like, to spend the effort to market, to re-release a movie, studios aren't going to do it. They'll do it in a sense, like, through the Fandango or National Cinema or NCM. I meant Fathom Events. They will do certain things, but only at select locations. It's technically not a re-release because they're only going to show the movie
once.
So, you know, you are looking at, and again, I'm trying to find what the location count for this movie was.
I'm interested. There was a company years ago, and I think they fell flat on their faces. But I want something like this to kind of, I want somebody to pick up the ball where, audiences could demand in their theater a movie to watch. So if you got X number of people, let's say 20.
Tug.
Yeah, but they didn't go anywhere.
Sort of kind of. Yeah. Well, but I think that's the distribution model that you're going on. You can book a theater. If you bring X amount of people, you sell X amount of tickets, they're going to show the movie. Yeah. And if you don't reach that goal,
you don't get it.
You don't get it.
And, you know, so I wanted, because, you know, their library just became like, what is this?
Right.
But if you could do that for the original Poltergeist and you got a group of people and you got to see in a theater, like, that's fun. And I really want someone to pick up the ball there.
Yeah, well, again, you know, we do have Fathom Events and NCM who have these things. For example, like, they're going to be showing this month in June, which I tweeted about this earlier today. 40th anniversary Jaws. They're going to show Jaws in the big screen for one night, two nights. I'm pretty much just predisposed that I'm going to buy a ticket for this because I haven't seen Jaws on a big screen in forever. And this is a movie that started it all. Like, I've seen Ghostbusters in this fashion. They did that with Ghostbusters. Not too long ago, Paramount was releasing some of their catalog titles. They did Raiders of the Lost Ark, which was so beautiful to see on the big screen. They even did Top Gun, and I see Top Gun, and I'm like, wow, this is great. Like, more studios should just pick a time. Just do a 1 week, 2 week run. Get audiences excited about this stuff. And when you have a movie that I think is as good as Poltergeist, you know, it could do some business. It's hit or miss. I know that they tried to do it with E.T. years ago, and it really didn't take off as well as Universal had hoped. I was there. I mean, because I love going back to see these movies on the big screen. Things like Casablanca, which, you know, things like Sunset Boulevard, other movies, black and white movies that would benefit. I enjoy going to see these things. There are those outlets out there. But, you know, you might not be able to do it for the original Poltergeist, but I'm sure you can find it on maybe YouTube or somewhere. You know, I have it on, you know, I have it on DVD, waiting for Blu-ray. You know, I just felt really bad for this movie. I will say that going in, that some of the marketing actually did entice me. I said, okay, their marketing is hitting the right, it was hitting the right chords with me, at least from a nostalgia thing, and how they repurposed the clown, for that matter. The whole thing with the clown and the nose, I sort of like that. Like, mm-hmm. You know, they repurposed that quite fine. But I don't know. box office.
But yeah, I don't think, you know, I think if the lesson to me is, it's like any, if you take a book and you adapt it to a movie, take the spirit of the book and then forget it. You know, read the book once, take the spirit of it and adapt it. So in this, and that was always going to be its trouble. A lot of critics, obviously, you know, we can't help but compare it to the first one, and same as everybody else. So if you're going to literally make it to such an extent in that way, just do something a little different.
I'm going to throw this out there. We'll probably, I'm sure, wrapping up pretty soon. But for the people who are watching us right now, first off, thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, we actually, Phil, I got to tell you, our live audience, you know, I read our comments and such, and our live audience has been, I think, fantastic for us. They may be few, and hopefully they're growing, but they actually spend the time with us. And we're talking about a podcast that's not a 30-second meme on YouTube, you know, and you're dubbing these people YouTube stars. We actually talk about movies for at length. And the comments I've been reading lately, whether it be for Ex Machina or whether it be for Mad Max, they've been fantastic. People have been chiming in, and, you know, I would say 98% of them, you know, there's always the negativity, which is fine so long as it's warranted. Don't be vicious, but it's been great. And I think our live audience who are watching us, number one, thanks, because you're putting in time to listen to a schmucks talk about movies, which is great. Well, but I'm just saying, like, you know, this is such a wonderful opportunity. So I am curious that the people who are watching, if they went to this Poltergeist like you without have seen the original.
I went to an AMC, there were a couple of young kids that I'm sure they did not see the original.
You don't think they saw it in any iteration, whether on Turner Classic Movies, or you think that they were that young, huh?
Not the kids I saw with.
I'm curious, and I don't know if Fox tried to do a breakdown. I'm sure there's information out there as to makeup of audience that has seen the original and not seen the original. And I'm curious. I mean, because, as I always am, for those who did not see the original, like yourself, you said, hey, I sort of enjoyed this movie. You know, I sort of enjoyed this.
How about this? I consumed the movie.
Sure. But, you know,
probably not.
I didn't know you hadn't seen the original. Mm-hmm. So when you said that to me, I'm like, okay, I guess that to an extent makes sense. And I wonder if that audience that may not have seen the original and understood it, if they enjoyed it as well. Because they could have. You know, I understand that they're trying to grab a new audience, a younger audience. You're going PG-13. The original was, I think PG-13 existed back in 1982. So that movie was a PG-13 horror supernatural movie as well. But I'm just curious, if anybody is watching live, let's take our own little straw poll and see, did you see the original? Had you seen the original? Did you see it recently because you were getting ready to see this Poltergeist? Or do you have no desire to see the original? Or have I bored you to death talking about the original? I'd buy that one too. But, you know, I say see the original and you'll see the foibles and flaws in this remake. So you went Blumhouse light.
There we go.
So, yeah. Has there been any, Brittany? Has anybody chimed in?
Yeah, there's a couple people talking about how they didn't see the original either.
And what were their thoughts on the movie?
Overall, they didn't really give me... No one's really said clear-cut what their overall thoughts were, but they're talking about just the quote-unquote, like, curses and bad luck that some of the production has had with the first one.
Oh, well, Jesus. There's a whole lore. You know, that's great to do. Did you know anything about this?
Yeah,
about the original Poltergeist? Well, there is what was deemed, what became known as the Poltergeist Curse. And it all started with the original Poltergeist. The girl that played Carol Ann's sister. So, you know, we had the same family makeup. We had a mother, father. We had an older sister, middle brother, younger sister, Carol Ann. She's the one that gets kidnapped. The older sister, whose first name, it could have been Danielle DeMille. She was the daughter of a very famous author, Nelson DeMille, I believe, is his name. She was murdered by her stalker boyfriend literally a week or so prior to release of the original Poltergeist. And since then, from Poltergeist 2, there was a gentleman, and he was a famous character actor. I believe he was even in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, this guy. You know, he died of a tragic death after filming Poltergeist 2. Carol Ann herself, the little girl that played Carol Ann after Poltergeist 3, she died of pneumonia. And there's this, and then Zelda Rubinstein, she passed away like recently, but there was a string of deaths that was following this production, the Poltergeist curse. That was in some way, like I said, that girl who was murdered, her boyfriend came up to her apartment and her house, and just, she opened the door and she just shot her. And this was like a week before the movie. And this lore, this mythology has been the Poltergeist curse, that even today's director, he believes that the Poltergeist curse has followed him into the production of this movie. He said that there was some strange going on while filming, you know,
that's
while
more
filming
scary
this
than
movie.
The movie.
It could be. So what else did they say about the curse?
Nothing too much else about the curse, but it looks like everyone's leaning toward the original. And a few of our viewers haven't seen the new one.
Interesting.
Oh, there you go. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And you guys have a question from Benjamin Workman.
Okay, Benjamin.
He wants to know what you guys think the scariest film of all time is.
That assumes I've seen all the scariest movies. I mean, I you know, Scream is a classic, things like
uh-huh.
that. To me, to preface it, Ben, I don't go beyond the more ones that kind of get to the more public surface. So those are the ones I'm aware of, and I very much jumped the bandwagon when it is a good movie. So like Insidious, you know, I wasn't there right from the start, but as soon as it came to existence of like, oh, this is a good movie, I'm like, all right, yeah, let's go see it.
Yeah.
And then now I'm really excited to see Insidious 3 because of that. I'll let you answer first because I don't know.
Well, you know, Ben, you ask a great question, and this is one that's awesome to be sitting around a bar having some beers and you know, some buffalo wings and whatnot. For me, as I said, my favorite horror movie is Halloween. I love that movie from, you know, from beginning to end. And the more I watch it, the more I actually, believe it or not, even after all the times I've watched it, I still pick out things that just it struck me differently. So I love the movie Halloween. But with that said, I mean, The Exorcist to me is still a pretty damn scary movie. I'm a really huge fan of John Carpenter's The Fog. I think that's a classic ghost tale, and I think it's underrated. I also love The Thing. The Thing is great, but the original Thing is a fantastic horror movie to watch as well. Of recent years, like I said, I believe The Conjuring is definitely one of the scariest ghost stories to come out within the past 10 years. I was really a big fan of Sinister. I think Sinister delivered some great chills and jumps. And when you talk about being on a roller coaster, that movie really delivered the ride. I'm trying to think of some other recent horror movies that have come out. You know, I wasn't such a big fan of like the Annabelle or whatnot. Oh, Insidious
yeah,
surprised me. I was very pleasantly surprised about what Insidious, you know, how it delivered its chills. You know, if you want to go into more gore fest, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call them favorites, but they're fun movies to watch, like Cabin Fever. Eli Roth took his cues from the 80s, and he just made a great, fun splatter fest. Movies like that I enjoy. I had the privilege to work on and with the Saw movies, and when Saw came out and what that did to revitalize the horror genre at the time, I thought was amazing. And another fun horror movie to watch, and it's a remake, is My Bloody Valentine in 3D. Look, if you're going to remake a movie, remake a cult movie that like 10 people saw back in its initial release and just do it good. And I think My Bloody Valentine 3D is a blast. Is it great? No, but man, first rated R horror movie to come out, and man, it used 3Ds to such good effect. It was just a lot of fun. I do enjoy the Friday the 13th movies. I don't find them scary, so to speak, but they are fun But just going back to that initial question, my favorite Halloween, or my favorite horror movie is Halloween.
There you go.
Yep. So did you? I gave you enough filler to think of something.
You know what?
What are some of them?
No, you know what? I'm gonna throw out something different. So this is not gonna answer the question.
Okay.
But I remember when Hostel came out.
Sure.
Everyone on Earth kept asking me, "Is this what Americans think of us here in here in Prague?" And I'm like, "No." But yeah, 'cause everyone I know in Europe had seen that movie.
Yeah, Hostel, again, I was at Lionsgate at the time, and Hostel was one of those movies. Okay, let me give you a, since we're talking about horror, if you don't mind digressing off of Poltergeist, sort of a fun...
We've digressed for the past 10 minutes, I know, so if you're with us, you're with us.
And maybe in October we should just have a horror panel, but okay, interesting story about Hostel. When it came time to marketing, it was a really difficult movie to market. And not exactly knowing who was going to show up. It was a harsh movie to watch. It's pretty sick and twisted. And Eli Roth, who's friends with Quentin Tarantino. Quentin Tarantino, as the story goes, really liked the movie. And we got him to put his name on the movie, which helped in the marketing sense because... Yeah, it just helped, like, market that movie. It's almost like putting Wes Craven's name on something. Like Wes Craven used to do that almost to the point where he lessened his, he watered down his brand, so to speak. But, we had no idea Hostel was going to hit such a nerve. And I mean a box office nerve. It did really well. And that's a sick and twisted movie. You know, Eli Roth is a Bostonian who made Good. It's not one of my favorite horror movies, but it surely left its imprint in that genre. So, you know, as did Friday the 13th when that came out, and that was an offshoot of Halloween. It's like, oh, what else can we do if there's another? Oh, there was Friday the 13th, and then there was Silent Night, Deadly Night, probably one of them, still today the most reviled horror movies of all time. Not very good, very cheap, but very fun to watch in its really bad way. So, you know, but you mentioned Scream.
Scream, you know, I like the original, you know, and even when Scream 4 came out, I thought they did a good job because they balanced. I mean, it had a tremendous amount of comedy, and yet they still did stuff very originally.
And it turned horror on its heels. Yeah. Did Ben, by any chance, did he write what his favorite horror movie is?
Let me check here. He had to leave.
Oh, bummer.
But it looks like before he left, he said, and I would agree with him on this, The Descent.
Okay. Oh, The Descent. Another really good, you know, that's a good movie. And again, this is, you know, I was fortunate.
Wrong Turn.
Elijah Dushku.
Yeah, you know, I don't know what it's not that great a movie, but I just remember rewatching a lot of times with friends.
Uh-huh.
So that was
I have to say too. You know, we talked about Hostel. I mentioned Cabin Fever, The Descent. I was fortunate to work at Lionsgate at a time when you know it was really horror movies were building up that studio. And The Descent was one of those movies that was fresh. It was original. It earned its jumps and scares. It was a good movie. And then we also released movies like Open Water. I do highly recommend that if you haven't seen it, go watch the French version of Hot Tension, which translated an American version called High Tension, but we Americanized it. And by Americanized it, they didn't think audiences would get a foreign horror movie, so they dubbed it. It's not a very good dub, not a very good cut of the movie, but go see the original French version, Hot Tension. It's a very, very well done, clever horror flick that earns its scares. You gotta earn the scare with me. Make it clever, and that's why something like The Conjuring, I think, really earns its scares. Did you end up seeing The Conjuring?
I saw The Conjuring.
Did it scare you? Did you jump?
Yeah.
So there you go.
Very few scary movies.
Any other great comments or anything anybody else wanted to ask about?
Well, there's one question, and so I haven't seen
it. When will I shut up?
No.
This will be the last one.
All right, okay. Last question was in regards to the new Poltergeist.
Sure.
Why couldn't the family just burn the house down with the clown inside?
I mean, that's just disrespectful. You know what I mean? That was going to be the biggest thing. And one of the things that I thought actually worked for the movie is that they addressed the issue of they couldn't just leave. You know, there was that one moment there they were just getting the heck out of Dodge. But I like the fact that, because ultimately, right, they went to the light. They got through the light. Right? That's the way it happened. I'm not making that up.
I guess, but, you know, much like in The Conjuring, like, they set it up where, you know, they bought that house with a wing and a prayer, and they had all their money tied up into the house. The guy was a truck driver, and they couldn't move. They just couldn't. They didn't have the cash to do it. And they sort of set up a similar fashion, like, well, why can't you just move? And
yeah, but by that, by the end of the movie, money wasn't an issue for me in that sense. Yeah. It was, you know, if your house is doing those things, it's like, okay. But I did like that we really, you know, to me, as I was watching, you can't just get away from something like this and leave it to whoever. Like, you gotta deal with the fact that this is a wrong and this is an injustice.
Yeah, and the original, if that person didn't see the original, they do something extremely clever with some pretty amazing special effects, specifically for 1982. I think it still holds up today. You got to see what happens to the house, but yeah, that's a great question. Why did they just burn the house to the ground? But I agree with you. You just can't. Yeah. Responsibility-wise, I agree with you. So
yeah, I mean, God, you know, then you're getting a whole other movie. You get the sequel of the ghost following them.
Yeah.
So now they're in the car.
Well, I hope we don't get, you know, because there were sequels that spawned off the original, and neither one of them lived up to the original.
What about the TV series?
It was very short-lived. I can't even recall it, to be quite honest with you. But the sequels to the original weren't all that great. And I can't imagine them sequelizing this. Yeah. So,
all right. Well, on that note, I believe we've covered everything. We've talked Poltergeist. We've talked Poltergeist original. We've talked horror movies. We've talked everything in between. So thank you guys for interacting with us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
If you're watching us or listening to us on demand, don't feel left out of the conversation. You can comment as well. That's what we're all here for. It's an ecosystem. It's ongoing. Next week, we're doing San Andreas.
Yeah, San Andreas at the very least.
And then after that,
can't wait to talk about disaster movies.
We're going
to
be doing Insidious 3, of course, and Entourage.
Jurassic World.
That's
Mission Impossible.
That's going to be coming up June 19th for Jurassic World. A lot of stuff to look forward to. We've got Ant-Man down the line. Yeah.
We still have a lot of summer to go, folks.
A lot of
fun summer.
It's been fun May so far.
I know.
All right.
It's been a lot of fun.
On behalf of Dimitri Panos, where you can be found at dmovies1701.
Yes, and that's MOVIES. Steven had written it down in Mad Max, MOVIEZ. But it's MOVIES. So it's dmovies1701. That's where you can tweet me.
There you go.
Follow me. Do whatever. Great. Love to have you on board.
And, of course, follow us here on Movie Anatomy. That's our Twitter. And, of course, here at the Popcorn Talk Network. Subscribe, rate, all that fun stuff. And share the wealth. Tell a friend, you know. We might not always do movies that you like, but, in general, we cover a lot of movies. So, you know what? If you miss a week, check back in. I'm sure there's a movie that you enjoyed. So,
you know, being that you were the one, and it was Kevin, too, like, this is an ongoing thing where you missed the movie at the theater. Shame on you if you did that. But if you catch up 6 months down the line, check through our library and watch it after you've finally caught up with this good movie or what and whatnot. And
I think we're like 220 strong.
Yeah,
we're getting up there.
We are
so a lot of content there, and of course a lot of content here on Popcorn Talk as well. We'll see you here next time for San Andreas.
Shake, rattle, weekend. And roll.
Bye, y'all.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.